Good morning.
Good morning.
Today I'll remember to introduce myself first instead of remembering partway through. My name is Fred Meadner. I teach at Valparaiso University in Indiana, I sometimes advertise up here. This piece of clothing showed up in my mailbox in a brown paper wrapper up here at the post office. Actually, it didn't show up in a brown paper wrapper. It showed up in this. And it's addressed to me, but there's no return address. So I have my suspicions. So this may be the start of a tradition. And there may be a clothing exchange happening. Actually, I have my friend Paul Olson, who will be here any day now for the board meeting, who is an English professor and track coach at Augustana Rock Island, years ago gave me an Augustana cross-country shirt, which I wear sometimes when I run, but usually just around. That way people think I'm actually a real runner. So I'm going to start wearing this, and people think maybe you'll think I'm a musician. Or something else that's really cool. So, anyway, well, even before this arrived, this morning I had planned some other hopeful hilarity. Since we're talking about blessing for all the families of the earth, and I'll be talking about what blessing is at all, I thought I'd start with a blessing this morning. Oh Lord, bless those who love us, and those who don't love us, may you turn their hearts. And if you cannot turn their hearts, may you turn their ankles, so we'll know them by their limping. You may or may not want to use that blessing. It's anyway. So yesterday, well, to back up again for those who haven't been here at all yet this week, my overall theme is cracked pots, the clay vessels that Paul speaks about in 2 Corinthians 4 that are filled to overflowing with God's mercy and reconciliation that is meant for all the world. And those cracked pots are the church, and they are us, and we're talking about a sequence of cracked pots in the Bible. And the first one was Paul himself, and the second one yesterday was Israel, and we're sticking with that one today. And what I want to begin with today is where we ended yesterday, namely that according to the way the book of Genesis begins, the people of Israel is God's chosen people, chosen for a very specific purpose. And the prophets will remind them over and over of this, that they were not chosen for their own sake, but they were chosen because of God's dream of somehow bringing blessing to all the families of the earth. And Genesis 1-11, as we saw yesterday, describes a world whose whole history is nothing but cracking up and curse. And God decides at the end of the flood story, curse does not fix anything. Punishment helps nothing. And so God will try blessing as a last chance to make something different happen. And Israel will be the agent of blessing, the seed of Abram and Sarah. But then the question comes, how do you bring blessing to all the families of the earth? How does one people become a blessing for everyone else? You know, it's a staggering thing to imagine in our own world, imagine it in the ancient world, a world that was essentially very tribal in nature, the societies, even Israel itself was fractured in multiple ways by tribalism. It was very difficult for centuries for them to become a unified people because they were really a bunch of tribes and they didn't like each other much more than they liked the Edomites and Moabites and Hittites and Perizzites and Uzzites and all the other ites that were around. So how does a people become a people? And then how in the world would you bring blessing to all the other tribes of the earth? What could that possibly mean? From a Christian point of view, many, many centuries later, of course, we would probably say some way or another that the blessing is apparent in the coming of the Christ, who is, as the New Testament teaches, the new Israel, and who on the cross brings a blessing and a reconciliation for all the families of the earth. But that wasn't what anybody had in mind in whenever it was that Genesis 1 to 11 was structured. No one was thinking of a crucifixion back then. They might have been doing a bit of it in their own way, but they weren't thinking of that as reconciliation. The Jews might later on in their history have thought of a blessing for all the families of the earth as Torah. That became a legitimate gift to, if not all, at least many of the families of the earth. To this day, many of the law codes of Western civilization, anyway, are in one way or another based upon significant chunks of Torah, including the Ten Commandments. And if we doubt that, all we need to remember is how many people want to post the Ten Commandments in our courthouses. Because there is a sense in which that is behind everyone, behind every law code, at least in the Western world. And it would be good if we could live in a world. There would be blessing for all the world if we could live in a world where we did stop and give thanks, instead of trying to change the world at least one day a week. If we did honor our parents, not just when we're little kids, and obey the safety rules, but later on in life when they need us and we need to diaper them and kiss them and love them and sing them over to the new sleep. If we did not steal each other's spouses and live our lives burnt up with desire for other people and use them as toys, if we did not murder either in our hearts or literally, if we did not steal in all the multiple ways that there are to steal, and so forth, life would be different and life would be better, right? There could be blessing for all the families of the earth. But the Torah comes long after. The Torah becomes Torah, and it takes its place in Jewish civilization long after the stories that we've read were first conceived of as Israel's calling among the nations. So what could these stories themselves, that's what I'd like to probe a bit this morning, what could the first idea have been about how one people could be blessing for all the others? Are there any clues in the story itself for what that might eventually mean? I'm going to start with a couple of really basic things and just talk about the word itself. The word blessing in Hebrew comes from its root comes from the word for your knees. And as a verb, it means to kneel. That's the base, the root meaning of the verb. All Hebrew verbs have three consonants. Barak. So you're used to hearing the word for blessing, perhaps sometimes in Almost everybody's heard at least Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Baruch Atah, and so forth. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe. That word, the base meaning is to kneel. And it seems, in terms of understanding it as a word that can morph into a word for what we mean by blessing, when you kneel before someone, you're going to get whatever it is they want to give you. Because when you're kneeling, you can't run away. So whatever they mean to grant you while you're in that posture, whether it's a blow to the head, or a fortune, or a gift for posterity, you're going to receive it. You're there vulnerable before them. What's interesting to think about, if that's the image, I think it is, I'm not absolutely positive, when you study the derivations of these words, you can't always be precisely sure how the imagery morphed. But if it is the vulnerability of receiving, think about the fact that we use this language not only to talk about our receiving from God, but God receiving from us. It's not merely that we ask God to bless us, but we bless God. We ask God to sit still and receive what we have to give. So there's a certain kind of interesting mutuality in this term, at least in the poetry of the derivation of the words.
So does the Hebrew name Barak come from that?
Yeah, that's what... Yeah.
Really?
So you want to start calling the president Blessed for short? Yeah, Baruch. The name Baruch simply means blessed. Yeah.
Does it feel prophetic?
Pardon me?
I'm looking at his face. I said, did it feel prophetic? His eyeballs are going up and down.
Well, lots of people have biblical names that don't realize it. And I would imagine that his name would not be Hebrew. I would imagine that his name, if anything, is Arabic. This is the same root in Arabic. This particular one is the same root in Arabic. Yeah, just like Shalom and Salem and are the same thing in Hebrew and in Arabic. Or a word that I'll use later this week, the word for compassion is the same. But I'll get into that later. If you read the story of the people, Abram and Sarai, after Genesis 12, where they are called to be the people through whom God will bring blessing to all the families of the earth, you can see that sometimes they do bring blessing to other people. Their presence among people seems at times to make those other people prosper. But as you know, if you read even the first few chapters after Genesis 12, Abram and Sarai become not only a threat to the very promise that they cling to, that they will become a great nation and a people who will bring blessing, but they begin to bring to other people the opposite of blessing. In one of the very first stories, we have this episode of, they go make a sacrifice when they get to the new land, but then Abram becomes afraid that people are going to want his beautiful wife, and so he starts passing her off as his sister, which of course she is. It's a half-truth. She is his half-sister. But instead of admitting that she's also his wife, she simply says to the Pharaoh, it's my sister, because he's afraid that they will do away with him in order to have her. And so for a time, Sarah ends up in the Pharaoh's harem, which is not a great way to start a family. So they are their own threat to this promise of becoming a people with that kind of behavior. But plagues begin to rain down upon the Pharaoh with a little bit of, we have a little bit of prefiguring of the Exodus here already at the beginning of the story. And the Pharaoh finally says, what's going on here? Something's the matter. We got, you know, what are you trying to do to me? And so the situation is rectified. So we get an example right away of behavior that does or does not bring blessing to other people. The thing I'd like to propose, however, as a way, not the way, but a way to imagine what this story would like to teach us about at least some things that could be blessing for the families of the earth would be to watch the progression of people who become the bearers of this very same promise. You'll remember that in our tradition of remembering these people, we think of that, well, we used to think of them as the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses will stand at the burning bush and talk about, or be told, excuse me, it's not him, it's God who says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We add Abram and Sarai now, and Jacob and his wives, Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and his wives. So the matriarchs and patriarchs who bear this promise. And I propose that there are things about the stories of who bears the promise and how we name them that may be a clue to what these stories originally thought might be ways that promise, excuse me, that blessing got born to the other families of the earth. This is a culture in which whatever you inherited from previous generations in the way of rights, property, and everything else went first of all to the firstborn, and then the younger siblings kind of divvied up whatever is left. I mean, that's not exactly the way the rules read, but that's a loose paraphrase. And many of you know that in the ancient stories of Genesis, that primogeniture business, the rights going to the firstborn, keeps getting short-circuited. All the way through the Old Testament, this seems to be a problem. The firstborn never quite makes it. So remember the difficulty Abram and Sarai had in having a child resulted in Abram having his firstborn by Hagar, the Egyptian, and that child's name is
Ishmael.
And does anybody remember why he's called Ishmael? Does anyone know what Ishmael? I know some of you know what Ishmael means because some of you know Hebrew. But it's a word that means that God has heard the weeping and the crying that has gone on in Hagar's life. That's the firstborn child to Abram, and it could be legally his heir. It could even be legally, because Hagar is Sarah's maidservant, it could even legally be Sarah's child, although it is not the child of her own body. But in the ancient laws of the tribal world, it could have been that way. But eventually then, as we know, Abram and Sarai have a child together. Sarai conceives, and they have a child, and his name is Isaac. And do you know what Isaac means?
Laughter.
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 Yitzhak is the Hebrew word, or tzachak is the verb for laugh. And Yitzhak means he laughs. It's onomatopoetic, right? Clearly. Tzachak! A certain kind of laughter. Hebrew is a very guttural language in a lot of ways. So he laughs. Okay, for exactly what kind of laughter is he named? What is there laughter in this story for which for which this child is named? Anybody
laughs,
remember?
Yeah, she laughs when she's told that she's going to have a child.
All right, that's...
Right, sure.
She's yeah, laughing. She's not the first one who laughs that way. Actually, Abram is the first one who laughs that way. Look at Genesis 17. Verses 17 and following. Start at 15. God said to Abram, "As for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name." And by the way, I forgot to tell you one of the principles I'm working with as we're doing this and why I think these names are so important. Every time in the Bible, in almost without exception, if a narrator or a character in a story stops to tell you the meaning of a name, you know that the meaning of all the names in the story have great significance. So, just for example, while it's not really among the most ancient stories of Israel, because it's in the writings portion of the canon, the book of Ruth is one of the really oldest, at its base, one of the oldest stories we have in the Old Testament in terms of the way it's told and so forth. And there's this moment in the book of Ruth in which Naomi, who has lost everything, she has lost her husband, she has lost her sons, and now she and her two daughters-in-law have to figure out how to make a life for themselves. And at that point, Naomi says, "Don't call me Naomi anymore." Because Naomi means pleasantness. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. "Because the Lord has made my life bitter." So she changes her own name and she explains why. So from then on, you should know all the names in this story are important. Check out the meanings. Now, this isn't really a session on Ruth, but because I started this, I'll finish it to just try to show you how this works. If you go back and look at all the other names in that story, you know, her two sons, the ones who died, Kilion and Malon, those names turn out to mean, well, for short, they actually mean sickness and something like sickness, you know, decrepitude. These guys didn't have much of a chance in the first place. Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, and Orpah is the back of your neck, which is finally what the last thing they saw of her was the back of her neck. And Ruth is the Hebrew word for friendship. So they go, this Moabite woman and the embittered Hebrew woman, they go back to the hometown, Bethlehem. And she gets taken into this Hebrew man's family. And the story is told to us the way we have it from the perspective of a long time later when it really becomes very interesting that this woman, this Moabite woman, got into the genealogy of David. And from our perspective, into the genealogy of Jesus, a Moabite woman. And this story was really especially important in the days when Ezra and Nehemiah, after the exile, absolutely insisted that every Hebrew, especially among the priests who had a foreign wife, had to divorce her and get rid of her and banish her, so as the last thing you saw was the back of her neck. There's this terrible scene at the end of Ezra where they send all these women and their children away, and there's this great wailing and weeping because they were so afraid of just being assimilated into the populations of the area post-exile.
Fred, I'm wondering if that idea that of assimilation of other people is a mainstream thought through the Old Testament, or is that just a tiny rivulet, and the Ezra thought, get rid of the foreigners, a mainstream thought?
Well, it's a constant tension, and it appears over and over and over again, and it's most likely it most likely appears where it does because of the fight about it in the later periods. So that you have justification over and over again for getting rid of the foreign women. I mean, that's at least one theory for why we have this appearing all the time. But that's a very complicated thing to try to unravel. But the one thing I wanted to say about the Book of Ruth and the importance of these names is the key name is the name of the woman that Ruth marries. His name was Boaz. Boaz is the first word in the building inspector's certificate of the certificate the building inspector would give you if your building was sure to withstand an earthquake. Actually, it's the second word, not the first word, I'm sorry. When you built a structure that was strong enough to withstand earthquakes, the person who came to check it would declare it Yakin Boaz, built in strength. Those words were on the pillars of the temple. On the one was Yakin, and on the other was Boaz. This place is built in strength. You can go in there, friends, and it's not going to fall down on you. And Boaz takes this Moabite Ruth, who made this vow of faithfulness to Naomi, into his house. And the point is, look, friends, the place is strong enough to withstand bringing in a foreign friend. These foreign women will not bring down the house. That's a part of the point of the Book of Ruth. But you don't get it unless Naomi says, read my name. What does my name mean? Start paying attention to what the names mean. So the parable, or the allegory, I guess it is actually, that's built into this story is woven in through the names. So it's more than just a story about a tender thing that happened in ancient Israel that got someone into the genealogy. It's a statement that's been made. Well, back to where we were.
Before you leave, what does Obed mean then? The son who's born.
Well, Obed is part of the is one of the word one of the ways to say the word for a servant. So God said to Abram in verse 15, "As for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, princess. I will bless her, and I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of people shall come from her." And Abram fell on his face and laughed. and said to himself, can a child be born to a man who's 100 years old and Sarah, who's 90 years old, bear a child? Are you kidding me? And Abram said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight. Please, let it be Ishmael, my firstborn. God says, no. Your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you shall call him Isaac. He laughs. And I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant. Okay, so Abram is the first one who laughs at the promise. And although he's now Abraham, he's no longer Abram when this happens.
What is the difference between Abram?
Pardon me?
What is the difference in the meaning between Abram?
Not much. Not much. They both basically mean the same thing. Exalted father.
And what about Sarai and Sarah? Same thing?
Same thing. They don't, there's very little difference in what they actually mean.
But if you're saying to pay attention to the names, then there's a significance that whatever was is no longer, but this is something new. Even if there are 190, we're a new person.
Right, you're a new person. That's right. The next laughter comes in chapter 18, when the three strangers show up to visit Abram and Sarai, and they Sarah is back behind the curtains when the conversation happens, and we'll pick it up at verse 9, I guess. They said to him, where's your wife Sarah? And he said, in the tent. One of them says, I'll surely return to you in due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. And Abram and Sarah were old, advanced in age, and had even ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Postmenopausal Sarah is listening to this. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I've grown old and my husband, have you seen him lately? Even now I'm supposed to have the pleasure of procreation? And the Lord said to Abram, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too wonderful for the Lord? At the time set, I'll return to you in due season, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied, saying, I didn't laugh, because she was afraid. And he said, oh, yes, you did laugh. So it sounds like this laughter is a problem, right? So do we really want Isaac to be named for this unfaith, this distrust of the promise, this skepticism, even of something close to cynicism? Is that the laughter for which Isaac is named? No. That's not the laughter for which Isaac is named. Flip to the point of his birth in chapter 21. The Lord dealt with Sarah as he'd said. The Lord did for Sarah as he promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abram a son in his old age at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abram gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore, and no reference is made backwards to where this, to the original instance of the laughter, but God had said, name him Isaac. Abram circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded. Abram was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him, and now Sarah said, and here's the interpretation of Yitzhak. God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. So the name Isaac, I mean, this child is named not for laughter at the promise and laughter at the prospects of blessing in old age. The child, Sarah gives meaning to the name. The child is named for laughter with, not laughter at. Everyone who hears about this will laugh with me at the goodness, at the blessing that God has given me, because God has given me laughter. So this laughter is a gift, and this laughter is shared. This is not the kind of laughter that is the laughter at, especially at hope, and laughter at prospects of blessing. So let's just hang on to that. I mean, there's a huge difference, isn't there, between laughter with and laughter at, even, you know, even in other kinds of settings. When you laugh at someone, it's very different than when you laugh with someone. Laughter with is one of the healthiest things there is among human beings. Did somebody tell me that the other day, here in this room, for one of these morning icebreaker things, what are we calling them?
Eye openers.
Yeah. That John Marty was up here and just had everyone laugh for 15 minutes. They just laughed with each other for 15 minutes. What a way to start the day. Better than coffee. So laughter with is a blessing. So that's the first child. That may not sound like such a great deal to you. That one of the first gifts through these people is laughter. But I invite you to think about it as a significant blessing for all the families up here. Isaac has a rough life. Almost immediately after he's born, at least the way the Bible tells the story, he gets hauled up on top of this mountain where God has asked his father to sacrifice him. And he asks a few questions about this, and God says, Abraham says, don't worry about it, we'll take care of this. And the next thing you know, he's got a knife over him. He is Mr. Passive the whole rest of his life. But that's another whole story. We don't really have time for that. Isaac gets a wife named Rebecca, and boy, it would really be fun to have time, and maybe we'll do that sometime later on, but we're not going to do it today. This couple has a pair of children, you'll recall, Esau and Jacob, and they get name for their birth story. Esau is the father of the Edomites. He comes out first. He's ruddy and he's red, which is what his name means. And his brother, when Esau comes out of the birth canal, you remember what's going on?
His brother's holding on to his heel.
Right, his brother's trying to pull him back in so that he can get out first. So the children are born with one grasping the other's foot, trying to pull him back. But Esau is born first, and Jacob is eventually born second. But Yaakov means he'll pull you back. He'll pull you down. He'll supplant you. The word is even used in some cases. The verb Yaakov is used for cheating, for taking a place you don't deserve. So that's the two boys. But we know that Jacob gets another name, right? In the long history of this family, what ultimately happens, I mean, there's all sorts of great stories here. Rebecca, who's running the show, by the way, Rebecca, I have a daughter named Rebecca who's sitting right back there, and I've told her about this name, so she knows this story. You know what Rebecca means? Rebecca is a rivka in Hebrew, is a noose. It's not this kind of noose. It's the kind of noose you lay on the ground with which you snare prey. You wait till they stand in there, and then you get one of their legs, and you got it. And you gave a daughter that name because you expected them to be beautiful enough to snare. Seriously, that's the meaning of that name and what the point of it is. But it's the perfect name for the Rebecca of the Bible. It's the absolute perfect name because no one gets out of her snare. She is in absolute control of that whole story. From the moment she's in her betrothal story, she's in charge. She decides whether she will marry this man. She's the only one in all the such stories of the Old Testament. She's the only one who makes the decision herself. She loves Jacob. Isaac loves Esau. Esau is the oldest. Esau should get the blessing. But Rebekah wants Jacob to get the blessing, so Rebekah rigs the whole thing and fools old Mr. Passive with this charade about the hair and the porridge and stuff. And Jacob gets the blessing, but then Jacob has to flee for his life. And Jacob goes and lives among the people back in the old country for part of his adult life. And then finally he decides, well, he's got to go back. He's got two wives and a bunch of kids. It's time to go back. But even as an adult headed back, he's not sure that he wants to face Esau because of what passed between them. He has fled for his life, and after all these years, he still doesn't know, because they don't have email, whether Esau is mad at him. But he's afraid that he probably is, so they're headed back. And if you'll turn, excuse me, if you'll turn to chapter 32, Genesis 32. He's on his way back, and chapter 32, verse 22 and following is the story. The same night he got up and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything he had, but he was left alone. I'm not exactly sure, but what this looks like to me is that he sends everybody else ahead, and then he lingers back. And they're out there ahead, and he's kind of waiting to see what's happening. This has at least a hint of him putting everybody else at risk so he can tell whether it's safe to continue. But in any case, Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket. And Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." That is, the other man said that. Jacob said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." So he said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Yaakov." And the man said, "You shall no longer be called Yaakov, but you shall be called Yisrael. For you have Yisrad, you have striven with El, with God, and with humans, and you have prevailed." Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." He said, "Why do you ask?" And he blessed him. And Jacob called the name Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face." Peni means face, and El means God. "I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip. This is why I read that blessing to you, about limping. Never mind. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the thigh muscle that's on the hip socket, because he struck Jacob on the hip socket at the thigh muscle. So there's an eternal memory of this moment among the people of Israel. You don't eat that body part, because that's the thing the Lord struck. And this reminds us of our limp as a people, the limp of people who have wrestled with God and lived. Now think about the context. Here's a man who has spent his entire life, beginning in the moment that he's born, trying to get the best of other people. Pulling them back, pulling them down. And he pretty much did it with his father-in-law Laban. He figured out a way. I mean, he had a lot of hard work and all that kind of stuff. But Jacob gets his way, and he gets his way by manipulating others. But along the way, he's constantly causing alienation and trouble. And now he's about to have to pay for all this. He's now about to face the brother who he cheated, who he yakled, pulled down and got the best of. And then at that moment, he has this experience. And he gets his name changed so that he's no longer the supplanter. He gets named for the fact that he wrestled with God. He didn't choose to. He didn't say, okay, God, come get me. The fight was put upon him. But his new name is Yisrael, the one who strives with God. What I believe about this story is that we're meant to see here that there's an enormous difference between making your life battle with other people and making your life battle with God. Your real battle in life, your real struggles, your real wrestling partner in this life is God. And most of the fighting you do with other people is really a fight with God, that you can't carry on with God, so you carry it out with other people. And we learned that already back in one of the earliest stories of all, back in Genesis 4, that was the problem. Two brothers, one of whom is thriving and the other not, and there's an attempt to fix this problem. How? Cain's fight was with God. It was not with Abel. But instead of going face to face with his real opponent, he kills his brother. So, a blessing for all the families of the earth is that, at least potentially, I think we can see this, that it would be a blessing for all the families of the earth if we could all learn to have our fight with the right person. If we could really see that our life struggle is with God, not with our brothers and sisters, so that we need to kill them to fix our problem, that would be a blessing. And quickly, the next generation. Jacob, and Rachel, and Leah, and the servant girls have all these children. Rachel has two of them, Leah has half a dozen, and the servant girls have some more. Who gets to be the heir of the promise in the next generation? Firstborn is Reuben. Secondborn is Simeon. Thirdborn is Levi. Are they the bearers of the promise? No. They're all children by the same mother, right? These are all Leah's children. But who gets the promise?
Joseph.
No, Judah. Joseph becomes, that's another whole story that we'll do a little bit next week, actually. But how these people get their names and the meaning of the Blessed One is extraordinarily interesting. Chapter 29, verses 31 and following, so I'll go back a little bit. This happens before Jacob gets his name changed. You'll remember that Jacob loved Rachel, and he agreed with Laban that he could marry her, but on the wedding night, Laban stuck Leah in the tent, and Jacob didn't notice till morning. And so he was married in the eyes of God and everyone else to Leah. Surprise, surprise. There's a whole midrash that explains how that could happen, which maybe I'll share another time. We don't have time for that this morning. But in any case, he then has to work 7 more years to get Rachel. And then what we read later on in chapter 29, verses 31 and following, that when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So, you know, there's hours and hours worth of stuff we could do on this. Through no fault of her own, except that she was loved, Rachel remains barren, which is her burden, and that's another wonderful and very rich story that we'll brush up against when we look at Jeremiah briefly. But in any case, Leah is who we want to look at this morning. The unloved woman. Leah conceived, and she bore a son, and she named him Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has looked upon my affliction. The name comes from the word for seeing. The Lord has seen what's going on with me and finally done something about it. Because when you bear your husband a son, that's the best you could hope for. And now, of course, he will love you. All this woman wanted was that her husband would love her. And she bore him a son. And surely now my husband will love me, she says. So she names her child for that hope. But as we all know, Jacob did not love her. She conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also and named him Shimon, which means he has heard. But still, Jacob did not love her. Got her pregnant every year, but didn't love her.
Did she not think tricking him in the beginning might,
It was the father who did that. The father was the one who pulled the trick. It was not Leah.
Well,
she could have said, no, I won't go. But again she conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will be joined to me because I have borne him 3 sons. And so she named him Levi, which means entwined. I've borne the guy 3 sons. If 3 sons doesn't wrap your husband around you, or wrap you around your husband, or cause some kind of, at least enmeshment, if not, love, nothing will. And still, Jacob did not love her. So she conceived again and bore a son and said, this time, I will praise the Lord. Notice this time, she doesn't say anything at all about Jacob, about her husband. That project is over. She's not bearing children anymore under the hope that these will earn her something. That has failed. That does not work. So this time, she names her child Yudah, which is the verb that's at the beginning of all the Psalms that start out, oh, give thanks. And here's the wonderful thing about this, and I love explaining this, and I've probably done it up here at Holden before, and others have seen me do this elsewhere. the verb yada, which means to give thanks, for which this child is named, what the root meaning of that verb actually is to throw something in the air. Or simply to make this gesture. To heave your hands into the air. That's what yada means. Now think about the position this woman is in her life. She has tried 3 times to get her husband to love her. She has given up. I mean, what are you supposed to do? I've done everything I can. You know, that's the gesture. But the other 3 boys, she offered up to her husband as an offering to get his love. This time, she's not offering up her child to anyone but the Lord. Here, God, this one's all yours, which is the gesture of giving thanks. Now, you know, I can't say that this is truly, truly an intention of this story, but it seems very enlightening to me. That the whole idea of naming a child for Thanksgiving, you know, at the end of this sequence, is some kind of wonderful lesson, some kind of wonderful blessing about the way we use the most precious things there are in our lives, including our own flesh and blood. There is so much temptation to use the most sacred and the most precious things we do to try to earn something. You know, there is so much temptation to use our children to gain advantage for ourselves, or to use them as some kind of way that will, if not earn us, you know, someone else's love, will earn us respect in the world. Don't you always hope that your children will bring a good reflection on you? Those of you who have children, don't we all? We're always trying to earn something by means of our children. And when we think our children fail us and they bring down shame upon us, you know, we think it's about us. So we're constantly using our own flesh and blood for our own advantage. And using everything that's a sacred gift as bargaining chips of some kind or another. What if we could learn to receive sacred things strictly as gifts and offer them up? You know, this is also the posture of receiving, right? As well as giving. You know, what if, so because it's about 40 seconds till 10 o'clock, to sum this all up, you know, I think it's possible that there's a storyline being woven here about what blessing is. Blessing is a lot of things. If the human family as a whole, all the families of the earth, could live in laughter with instead of laughter at, and if we could make our struggle in this world with God and not with each other, and if we could learn to give thanks rather than using even the most holy things as bargaining chips, wouldn't there be blessing? I think it's at least possible that's the story is trying, the way the story weaves out with the people of blessing, that it teaches those things. I didn't leave any time for questions, but I'll hang around for a moment. Any quick questions or comments, thoughts about this?
I'm always trying to make this practical. I was wondering how pastoral it would be if you're in the surgery prep room with a person getting ready to be taken away for a hip replacement, and you talk about, you know, you've been wrestling with God all your life through the people that you've been interacting with, and now God is going to bless you today through the surgeon with a new hip. Does that work?
Hmm.
depends on what that person's name is.
Well, I could imagine that that could lead to meaningful conversation with some people, but there might be others who say, you know, I didn't pay for a Bible class right now. I'm really hoping this surgeon knows what he's doing.